I don't know if you
want to clip that on, or if you want to just...
How long is it? Long's it.
Would you rather have the chair or the swing?
Yeah, this is fine.
This isn't quite long enough, I guess.
No, it isn't. Okay. Now it's definitely working. I'll just hold it. Well, Michael, I'm primarily just interested in your memories of Ivydale and the Morris Brothers and that period of time where they were doing the festivals, 1969 to 73.
Well, you know, Bob, on the one hand, I feel like my memory is really pretty dim about that stuff. And on the other hand, I do have these images of that whole chapter in my life, just sort of images, and if I could somehow wrap around some of those. Yeah, I did a lot of, most of my growing up in eastern West Virginia, and learned to play music with some old-time musicians back around Cape and Bridge, and Pleasantdale, and learned how to play guitar, trying to follow old fiddle players around there. So I came at this with an intense interest in old-time music and an understanding, at least based on having grown up around it, an understanding of what old-time music was and sort of some notions about where it came from. So that was the musical side of my interest in the Morris Brothers. But there was another side too, and that was that what year are we talking about? 1969?
69 was the first festival, yes, yeah.
1969, maybe in the very early spring, or the late fall of 68, or the very early spring of 69, I was working for the Highlander Folk School in Knoxville, Tennessee, under the direction of Miles Horton. And supervised by Mike Clark, and our emphasis was Appalachian leadership program. And those of us on staff there had come out of the Poverty War programs of the mid-1960s, the Appalachian Volunteers working in East Kentucky and southern West Virginia. And so we had a lot of contacts around the region, and this program at Highlander was a way for us to follow up on those contacts and try to affirm the leadership that we had run into in the earlier programs, and try to help people get together around particular issues. Highlander's emphasis was peer group education, and so if you found people in one community fighting a strip mine, and you knew of people somewhere else that were fighting another strip mine company, you might, one tactic was to try to get those two communities together to learn from each other about what strategies that they could develop, and to try to widen consciousness about various kinds of issues all over the region. And culture always played a big part in that. And Woody Guthrie was associated with Highlander, and Pete Seeger. I think the Almanac Singers were involved back in the late 30s and early 40s. And Guy and Candy Carawan were major forces in more recent years in shaping the cultural programs for Highlander. And so, working in southern West Virginia, I stopped in to see Don West, and found that Don was tearing down old houses around in the community to get lumber to build a stage for a major festival that he wanted to have at the Appalachian Folklife Center there in Pipestem, West Virginia. So the Highlander staff agreed that I should invest time and energy in helping Don make that festival go. Don West and Miles Horton had both come out of the organizing movements of the 1930s among farmers and miners in West Virginia and Tennessee, and so there was some overlapping philosophy among those two, some stylistic differences perhaps, and so it was through my associations with Don West at Pipestem and actually helping to build the first stage for the first festival there that I met the Morris brothers in the dining room one evening. And I thought it was some sort of a visitation. I couldn't imagine there was two guys that were really like that who were brothers, who could sing like those two could sing, who had the sort of freewheeling spirit and independence to do whatever they wanted to do. To me, they looked like the Second Coming. David was a Vietnam veteran, had very solid politics around issues of Vietnam and veterans, and both the brothers were real savvy about the politics and economics of southern West Virginia in terms of outside ownership of wealth, and both, I think, felt that they wanted to try to build a solid community base around a new affirmation of the old culture. So I started including Ivydale in my swings through the region, and was actually staying at their house with them, met their parents. Their mother, you know, was a great old ballad singer. I don't know if David ever recorded her or John.
I know he's mentioned his father as being a source for some of his material and learning songs from him, but I don't recall him mentioning his mother.
Well, his mother was a sung some beautiful old ballads, and I always wanted to go back and sit down with her and listen to all those, because I think she was pretty shy about getting up on stage, although she may have actually sung at one point there, but I can't remember ever a public performance by her. But the stage was set up right in their yard there by their mother and dad's, by their home place there on, is it Otter Creek? Mm-hmm. Just a turn up the road from Ivydale. And an ideal location for a small festival like that, I guess, until the rain started coming down.
Was the festival site the same, you think, for all 4 years to date?
No, I think they moved the stage away from the house up the creek a little bit, but I can't remember exactly how things were situated. I know John has ended up living on a place that adjoins the family place. But so I it seems though like the stage was moved up the creek a little bit.
When I remember, and I was there in 73, it was a little bottom, kind of came down the hill, and you had to cross the creek, and mm-hmm. there was a little bottom, nice flat area in there, and the stage was kind of at one end, and I don't remember any houses being real nearby.
Yeah.
There were a couple outbuildings, you know, but I'll have to ask Dave about
it. I don't remember all exactly where the different locations were, but there was a lot of preparations in the house though around the festival. I think his mother tried to have some food, maybe some of the neighbors brought in some food and beverages but it was those trips driving around Clay County with David and John that I have the most feeling about, because they took me to meet people like Phoebe Parsons and I remember Dave and I stopped in there one afternoon. It must have been Thursday before the Friday festival started, and to see Phoebe Parsons, and I couldn't believe how far back in the country we traveled to see her. And we finally got up to her porch, and David said he had come to remind her about coming over to Ivydale to the festival, and I think one of our children was supposed to bring her or something. Oh, she said she wouldn't be able to come. She couldn't come. She was expecting sickness. That was the first time I'd ever heard that. And David told me later that she met her daughter was about to have a baby. Mm. But so we traveled around and talked to all these neighbors, Doc White and different ones up through there that were scheduled to appear, and they most of them turned out, and there was some really fabulous performances. I suppose David taped those originally.
Yeah, I understand that the Augusta Heritage people have all the tapes. He gave them the tapes.
Yeah,
years back.
I gave them all my tapes too.
Okay. I'm not sure if all the years have been recorded, but I'm assuming that they all have.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't really gotten access to those yet, but you know, Jerry did seem to say it would be possible. So.
Uh huh. Well, I think the festival was enhanced by the closeness of the relationship between David and John. I think a lot of people saw them as kind of the second coming, just almost too good to be true, you know. They were the real thing, and they were a younger generation when I guess a lot of people were thinking that this was a music that was dying out. These guys came along and pumped a whole lot of new life into it, and pumped a whole lot of excitement into those older musicians who came out. And I just remember, I can't remember all the names and all the songs they sing. It would be fun to go back and review those tapes if there are any. But I just remember some really sterling performances, wonderful, funny. Genus Cottrell and Genus and Sylvie, and getting to know them, going to visit their home, getting to know them was a great experience. So I think the contribution of the Morris brothers is you just can't begin to calculate what a valuable contribution they made. And I'm really sorry that they didn't stay together and continue to play together. I guess most of the brother acts that we know of through time sort of come and go. But they both did interesting things independent of one another too. And David, of course, has had a more visible career than John and has devoted all of his energies to it. And but John has stayed home and continued to visit around the neighborhood and continued to hang out with or help to bury those old musicians one by one as they died off. But he's retained an awful lot of that stuff. Anybody that thinks that that David has carried on the tradition by himself needs to go and sit down with John and see what's going on. We had him up to Augusta. As an old master, we usually look for people twice his age or three times his age to come and talk about the old music and the old people that played it. But John is just a natural treasure himself, and plays admirably on all instruments, as near as I can tell. Plays a fiddle that'll make your hair stand on end. So maybe you need to ask me some questions or something.
Okay. Those are
too general, those comments. Be
well,
very helpful.
I think anything is helpful, you know. Some people mentioned your slide presentation that you did at one of the festivals as being something that they remembered from the festival, something that stood out for them. Did you do that with, were you working with Rich Kirby at that point, or was it Doug Yarrow?
Yeah, it was Doug Yarrow. Doug Yarrow and I had been on staff of the Appalachian Volunteers working in eastern Kentucky. He was working in Martin County, and I was over in Breathitt County, Wolf County, that center section over there. He was way up next to the West Virginia border. And he got real involved in the Black Lung movement. He was a ace photographer, outstanding photographer, and he did the picture of Nimrod Workman and Phyllis Sue, I think, that's on the cover of Walking Through the Garden. Just stop you, a picture that'll stop you in your tracks. He had a picture on the cover of Newsweek magazine, taken during a strike of a state police and a picket standing nose to nose, and on the picket line, and some beautiful color studies of mountain scenery and foliage, and just a fantastic photographer. And I did a lot of songwriting during the 60s, and well, not a lot. I wrote a half a dozen songs, maybe. But also learned other contemporary songs that were being written about social issues at that time. Stuff by Billy Ed Wheeler and Gene Ritchie. Hazel Dickens was always a hero of mine, a heroine, a shero, a shero of mine. And Rich Kirby, of course, was somebody I admired a lot and partnered up with for a while.
Did Doug and his wife write the song Buffalo Creek?
Mm-hmm.
It's based on the Woody Guthrie tune?
Yeah. Yeah.
The music, anyway.
Logan County, where coal is the king, and People work so hard for most everything. On Buffalo Creek it was raining and gray, and the people was arising to meet the new day. The Calumet, Michigan, and the Copper Country, and the death of 73 children was the original Woody Guthrie version of that song. Yeah, they wrote that song together, and it was I think it was during this time that after the demise of the Appalachian Volunteers, Doug and I made a commitment to put the show together. We didn't have a grant. We didn't have any income at the time. I used to travel over to Beckley over a six-month period and spend a few days with him, usually a long weekend. And we assembled 750 slides to be shown on two screens. Everything from children playing in the hunting crawdads in a creek to their parents marching on a picket line, to people working underground in the mines, to some horrendous scenes of strip mining. And so we assembled these pictures and developed an all-musical commentary. Nothing spoken. And there were some sound effects that were recorded. For example, the show opened with real pretty pictures of old time scenes around, old people and old time scenes around the mountains. And then suddenly, and I was playing on the mandolin a medley of familiar old tunes, and then suddenly the sound of a bulldozer comes up and drowns out the music, and then the lights go out on me, and this huge picture of this dozer getting closer and closer and closer, and this grinding noise. And people would actually, because they were so lulled into the beauty of the opening scene when that dozer sound came up, people would actually be looking for somewhere to hide. You know, I wonder if I can get under my chair, or, you know, is the thing coming through the wall behind me? Or a lot of people told me they had that reaction to it. And then one song right after another from Billy Ed Wheeler's, "They Can't Put It Back," down in the valley about a mile from me where the crows no longer cry, there's a great big earth moving monster machine stands 10 stories high. To "Which Side Are You On," and all the songs that we could find. And sometimes there'd just be a verse of one, and then jumping into something else, and then coming back later to another verse of a song. And it was just this all musical commentary. It lasted an hour, 750 pictures. And the night, the Ivydale performance of that and the Pipestem performance of that were the two that stand out in my mind. At Pipestem, I think there were about 8,000 people sitting out on that hillside. And afterwards, some guy came up to me and said, "You missed an opportunity. You could have had everybody there on their feet marching to Charleston, marching on the legislature that night. You know, and they'd have been there by Monday morning if they'd left Saturday night. And you didn't, you know." But I don't know that I agree with his analysis of that, but it was, visually, it was a very, very powerful thing. And then the songs were songs that everybody knew. And all the songs that I write are parodies on using other tunes, familiar tunes. It's not that I couldn't write another tune, I suppose, but Woody Guthrie and Pete Seeger and other people worked in that tradition too, of trying to work off of, to get some familiarity, so that people could identify with the music and join in easily. And so that was the show. It was called They Can't Put It Back, after Billy Ed Wheeler's song, which I was credited with in Guy Carawan's book. Because I sang it so much, I guess everybody thought I must have written it. Yeah. It's a Billy Ed Wheeler song. And it was great fun to do. We did it for, I don't know, a couple of years, I guess. We did it everywhere from little back porches in East Tennessee we went out to the National Student Association meeting in Boulder, Colorado, to perform it out there. And we played up at Harvard University and just all over really stirring places like Antioch at Yellow Springs. You couldn't do anything wrong for that crowd.
Yeah.
And this is impossible to tell on this tape to people who didn't live through that time. Mm-hmm. Didn't live through the spirit of that time, because we don't have anything like that spirit now, unless this whole new Republican thing could be somehow equated with it. It'd be sad to equate it with it, but because this is, that energy was so positive, and the feeling that we were going to, in our lifetimes, we were going to see things really turn around and sort of people come first, and maybe redistribution of wealth in the region or in the whole country or in the whole world. We really felt like that was going to be possible within our lifetimes. And I think so this music all spoke to that, and people jumped in and sang. You could get the whole audience is singing right along with these things because they believed it. And that's something that it's hard to explain to somebody now who has never lived through a time like that. But so it was really fun to do the show there. It was in sharp contrast to a lot of other things that were done, because it was about contemporary life, and it wasn't just a celebration of old music and old images, which are real important, but it was something that was contemporary. But I don't think it was offensive, at least not, we didn't use electric guitars or drums or anything like that. It's a lot of fun to do.
Yeah. Well, it seems that there were a lot of things going on at that time, and I think the social activism that was happening was part of that whole period of time. It was an important part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the people that were the younger people that were coming to the festival at that time, it was probably their first introduction to real mountain music, but they were bringing with them the whole context of a lot of these other issues, you know, to the festival. And one of the things that somebody mentioned was that it was one of the first times that, with the, as divided as the country was then about so many things, that you had kind of young, long-haired, hippie-type people intermixing with these people out of the hills, and it all seemed to go pretty well. I mean, there weren't too many problems in that respect, and it was kind of an eye-opener, I think, for some of those people that it was possible to, you know, on both ends, you know, it was possible to get along. And,
of course, I always wore my hair short, and I wore long sideburns and kind of a truck driver's hat and work shoes, and because every time I turned around, I was doing something. I was helping somebody build something, or I was 1 minute and trying to teach a class the next minute, and my activities were very varied in those days, as they are now. But I was very interested in as committed as I was to the old culture and to the traditional communities, and to advocating for them and doing whatever could be done to support those communities. I was also interested in the newcomers, the people who were dropping out of urban life or suburban life and forming a whole new class almost of people who were coming back to the land. It wasn't the first time in this country that people had gone back to the land, but it was a very evident thing. It was in the mountains. Because, of course, the communities were small and everybody knew everybody. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there were a whole new bunch of people that nobody knew. And they looked different. And they made no particular pretense of trying to fit in, except that they were interested, I think, across the board. I think the new class of people were interested in the values of the old class. I think they were interested in family. I think they were interested in homesteading. They were interested in agriculture, growing things. All kinds of things, and which was back and forth about the choice of crops to grow was interesting too. Homeschooling, the hippies, the new class of people, wanted to get away from big regimented things. They were interested in the little concepts of one-room schooling or homeschooling that had been prevalent in the